Hello, I'm Paul Barclay, and you're with Fora Radio here on ABC Radio National at abc.net.au/rn. What was once thought scientifically impossible has increasingly become part of our everyday lives. How close is science fiction to science fact? Well, today on Fora Radio, theoretical physicist Dr. Michio Kaku takes you on a journey to the frontiers of science and beyond. What you might think far-fetched is actually possible. You'll hear all about invisibility cloaks and teleportation. They're not only abstract theoretical ideas, says Dr. Kaku, but have been proven in laboratory experiments. Then later on Fora Radio, the ABC's Sally Neighbour discusses her book on Rabia Hutchinson, the Australian woman who was once married to one of Osama bin Laden's inner circle and worked as a doctor on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, later to return and live under the rule of the Taliban. An amazing life story coming up on Fora Radio. But now to the physics of the impossible. And Dr. Michio Kaku, a theoretical physicist, best-selling author, TV documentary presenter, and popularizer of science. He's the co-founder of string field theory and continues Einstein's quest to unite the four fundamental forces of nature into one unified theory. He holds the Henry Samat Chair and Professorship in Theoretical Physics at City College of New York, and is also a visiting professor at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. So let's now join Dr. Michio Kaku at the RSA in London.
Today, we will be talking about the impossible. When you talk to a doctor and you say that a disease is incurable, it's a challenge. When you talk to a physicist and you say something is impossible, like invisibility, force fields, time machines, warp drive, that's a challenge. So we are going to talk about the future. It's always dangerous to predict the future. I quote from that great philosopher of the Western world, the great baseball player Yogi Berra. He once said, quote, "Prediction is awfully hard to do, especially if it's about the future." But I'm a physicist. We invented the laser. We invented the transistor. We created the internet. We wrote the World Wide Web. We created x-rays, television, radio, microwaves, MRI. Almost all the wonders you see around you were invented by a physicist. However, sometimes our predictions don't come true. When we helped to invent the internet, one physicist made a prediction that his brainchild would become a forum of high culture, high art, and high society. Well, today we know that 5% of the internet is pornography. But that's because teenage boys log on to the internet. Just wait till the grandmas and grandpas log on to the internet, then 50% of the internet will be pornography. So before I begin a discussion of the fantastic world of Harry Potter, the world of Star Trek, the world of the Terminator, the world of the X-Men, let me begin with a cautionary story about the impossible. Over 200 years ago, we had the great French Revolution. And one day, there were three gentlemen about to lose their head to the guillotine. There was a priest, there was a barrister, and a theoretical physicist, just like me, about to have our heads chopped off. Well, they put the priest's head on the chopping block, and they asked him, "Do you have any last words before we cut your head off?" And he said, "Yes." He said, God from above shall set me free." Well, the mob said, "Impossible. Impossible." They've seen hundreds of heads fall off. Nowhere did the hand of God stop the blade. Well, all eyes were on the blade. The blade rose. The blade fell and swoosh, and it stopped right before it hit the neck of the priest. Well, the mob had never seen this before. So the mob said, "The impossible has happened. By the grace of God, let the priest go." And now let's see about the barrister. Yes, they put his head on the chopping block. And they asked him, "Do you have any last words?" And he said, "Maybe the spirit of justice shall set me free." "Impossible," said the mob. Well, they raised the blade. It came down, swoosh, and it stopped right before it hit the neck of the barrister. Well, this time the crowd went crazy. People were dancing in the streets of Paris. "God has spoken today," they said. "Justice has spoken." And now let's see about the theoretical physicist. Well, they put the physicist's head on the chopping block, and they asked him, do you have any last words before we lop your physics head off? And he said, yeah, I got some last words. And he said, you know, I don't know too much about God, and I know even less about the law, but I do know one thing. If you look up, you'll see that the rope is caught on the pulley. And then he said, if you remove the rope, the blade should come down real good. Big mistake. Big mistake. The rope came down, the blade came down, and the poor physicist's head came down. And the moral of the story is sometimes we physicists have to know when to keep our mouths shut. Nonetheless, let us take a look at the history of the impossible. 100 years ago, during the end of the Victorian era, this was the greatest British physicist, Lord Kelvin, lauded by society. People were always in search of a quote and a prediction by the greatest Victorian physicist of his era. He made a series of predictions. Every single one was wrong. He said, airplanes, bah, humbug, heavier than aircraft, he said, violate the laws of aerodynamics. X-rays, ha, he said. X-rays are obviously a hoax. There's no such thing as X-rays. Radio, yes, radio exists, but it has no use, no possible use for radio, maybe to communicate to ocean liners, but other than that, no use for radio. And the Earth was impossibly young, only a few million years old. Why were all these predictions wrong? It's because Lord Kelvin had the misfortune of living just before Albert Einstein and the birth of the quantum theory. Everything changed when Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr introduced two revolutionary new forms of physics. Even the New York Times got it wrong. This is Robert Goddard, father of American rocketry. The New York Times denounced him in a major editorial, saying he's wasting taxpayers' money because rockets cannot move in outer space, said the New York Times, because there's no air to push against. Well, you don't need air to push against to make rockets move. They move because of Newton's third law of motion, action, reaction. The only hot air we now know was in the editorial office of the New York Times. So I like to quote from Arthur C. Clarke's Three Laws of Impossibility. The third law is my favorite. I think about it almost every day. The third law of impossibility says, quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about magic, things that come from mythology, science fiction, and are now entering the laws of physics. First of all, when you see Star Trek, or you see the Terminator, or you see Angels and Demons talking about antimatter bombs, realize that most of what you see on this silver screen is possible. These are called Class 1 impossibilities, I say. Possible in the coming years, decades, maybe 100 years at the outset. Telepathy, robots, antimatter bombs, forms of teleportation, invisibility, all within the laws of physics. Very soon, you will see objects literally disappear because we can already do that on a small scale. Class 2 requires many centuries of work, but also are possible, for example, time travel and perhaps even warp drive to the stars. Class 3 impossibilities are simply downright impossible. For example, perpetual motion machines, getting something for nothing. Every year, some inventor swindles Wall Street, convince millions of investors to invest in their perpetual motion machine. So the Wall Street Journal wants a quote from me, so I give them a quote. I quote from that other great philosopher of the Western world, P.T. Barnum. He once said, quote, there's a sucker born every minute. So let's talk about invisibility. First of all, the Greeks were fascinated by invisibility. Plato even writes at length about invisibility. Plato said that any man with a ring of invisibility would be tempted to kill the king and become the next king. Therefore, said Plato, the temptation of invisibility is so great, you cannot trust man to govern himself. You must have laws. You must have a stable government. because the temptation of invisibility is simply too great. However, now we can do it. Now, there are problems. Let's be blunt about this. If you are inside the invisibility cloak, you cannot look outside. You have to drill two holes. So from the outside, you see Harry Potter's two eyeballs floating in midair. So there are some problems that still have to be solved. But the basic principle of invisibility has been demonstrated. Many of my friends now are jumping into this game. It's one of the hottest fields now in physics. So we went from Greek mythology to fact. And this is how it's done. These are new materials called metamaterials, and this is what they do. You know that if you put a boulder in a river, water wraps around the boulder, reforms at the other end. So downstream, you're not aware that there's a boulder upstream. That's how it works. Light, we once said, cannot do this until recently. At Imperial College here in London and Duke University, they did it. So this is now done. We now have to enlarge it from to a small microscopic scale to a large scale, but that's a technical engineering problem. Now let's go to something called teleportation. Wouldn't it be great to simply zap your molecules across the room? Well, believe it or not, we actually have teleported individual atoms and photons using this device. The world's record is 600 meters right across the Danube River. That's how far we have teleported a particle of light called a photon. So every time I watch Star Trek, I smile when Captain Kirk says, "Fire the photon torpedoes." A photon torpedo is a flashlight. So teleportation of atoms, cesium, rubidium, and ytterbium, have been done. In fact, we're now filming the entire book for the Science Channel. ITV-TV and the Science Channel in the States, we're filming every single chapter of the book, Physics of the Impossible, to be made into a 12-episode TV series that I'll be presenting. In fact, we're halfway through filming it right now. Just 2 weeks ago, we went to the University of Maryland, and we actually photographed an atom being teleported about 1 meter across from this chamber to this chamber. You can actually see the blip created when an atom is teleported from one side to the other side. So maybe in a few years, the first molecule will be teleported. But then you begin to wonder, well, what about organic matter? What about a gene, a virus, a cell? That may take longer. A human will take, of course, even longer than that to teleport a human. But these are engineering problems. But it raises a question. You have to die in order to be teleported. So you see Captain Kirk dissolve, and there's a new Captain Kirk over there who insists that he's the real Captain Kirk. So you begin to wonder, what happened to the soul? If you just died and went to heaven, then who's that person over there if he has all your memories and all your personality quirks? It makes you wonder. Now let's say a few things about Death Stars. People liked the movie Star Wars, but the critics said, ha, a laser beam that can blow up a planet? Give me a break. Actually, it is possible to do this. I know this because I was once offered a job designing hydrogen warheads. Let me explain. When I was a child, I was fascinated by the laws of physics. I saw the old Flash Gordon series on television, and I was hooked. Starships, ray guns, aliens from space, that's for me. So when I was around 17 years of age, I decided to be part of this great revolution. I went to my mom, and I said, "Mom, can I have permission to build an atom smasher in the garage?" A 2.3 million electron volt Betatron electron accelerator, to be precise. My mom stared at me and said, "Sure, why not? And don't forget to take out the garbage." Well, I went to Westinghouse. I got 400 pounds of transformer steel, 22 miles of copper wire, and we wound it on the football field, 22 miles of copper wire. The magnetic field was 10,000 gauss. That is enough to pull the fillings out of your teeth if you got too close to my machine. Finally, it was ready. It consumed 6 kilowatts of power, enough to kill you. I closed my eyes, I plugged my ears, I plugged it in, I heard this crackling sound as 6 kilowatts of power emerged from my capacitor bank, and then I heard this pop, 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 pop sound as I blew out every single fuse in the house. The whole house was plunged in darkness. And my poor mom, you know, she had a hard life. She comes home from work, the lights flicker and die, and she says, okay, where's the fuse box? And I imagined her saying, why couldn't I have a son who plays football? Maybe if I buy him a basketball. And why can't he find a nice Japanese girlfriend? I mean, what's wrong with him? He builds these things. Well, because of that, I earned the attention of Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb. He actually got me a scholarship to Harvard to finance my budding career, and he offered me a job designing hydrogen warheads. I said no. However, one thing I learned is that there's no limit to the amount of energy you can put on a beam, including naturally occurring death stars. This is a gamma ray burster. It is the largest source of energy in the universe. It could fry beams, along these beams of the North Pole and the South Pole, it can fry a solar system from thousands of light years. Well, believe it or not, one of them is pointed right at us. The North Pole of WR104, shown right here, is pointed right at us. We're staring at the gun barrel of a gamma ray burster about to take place. This is what the Hubble Space Telescope tells us about WR104, pointed at us. You're staring down the gun barrel of a potentially unstable star. It will supernova, release a burst of energy. It is 8,000 light years away. Meaning that 8,000 years ago, maybe it already blew up. And you're doing your laundry tomorrow. You look up in the sky, and the sky's on fire. Well, could that happen? The answer is yes. But most astronomers, I think, believe it'll be a dud. We know very little about gamma ray bursters. All we know is that here's one pointed our way. We're monitoring it very carefully. But again, most astronomers think that it may be a dud, in which case the energy won't reach us 8,000 light years away. Now let's just say a few things about telepathy. Wouldn't you like to read somebody's thoughts, find out what they're thinking, or move objects by sheer thought? That's the power of a god, to be able to have mind over matter. Well, we can do it, in a sense. This gentleman here on the lower left had a stroke. He is paralyzed. On the lower left, you see an electrode, a red electrode, that is placed in the dead part of his brain, hooked up via an electrode to a laptop. By looking at the laptop, he can move the cursor on the screen, and he can now, even though he's totally paralyzed, he can now do crossword puzzles, surf the web, read emails, and answer emails, even though he is paralyzed. In the future, that thing on top of his brain will be reduced to microscopic scale, and in the future, even normal people may be able to surf the web just by thinking about it, by having an electrode attached directly to the brain. And not only that, but we can even read thoughts to a degree. When you tell the truth, a part of your brain lights up. However, when you tell a lie, first you have to know the lie, you have to know the truth, you have to know the cover-up, you have to know the consequences of the cover-up, and the consistency of the cover-up with all the other lies you've been telling all these years. That takes a lot of energy. Your brain lights up like a Christmas tree. So with 95% accuracy, we can now tell whether you're lying or not. Also, if you take a look at the upper right, we can identify the patterns of what you're looking at. A cat, a dog, a house, they register certain patterns. So a dictionary of thought is something that we are now creating. It only has about 20, 30 words in it right now. Eventually, this dictionary of thought may have hundreds, thousands of words. And computer technology is so great now that this, we think, is the future of the internet. This is how you will surf the web via your contact lenses. In your contact lenses, you will have full-blown internet capability. You'll be able to download any video, teleconference at work. This is the future of your home office and the future of your home entertainment center. This chip will also recognize people's faces. So next time you bump into somebody at a conference like this, and you say to yourself, I know this person. Who is this person? Jim, John, Jake, who is this person? In the future, your contact lenses will say, it's Jim, stupid, remember? You saw him last year at the last conference. You want to see his entire biography? Or if you're looking for a job and you're at a cocktail party and you don't know who to talk to, in the future, you'll know exactly who to suck up to at any cocktail party. Plus the fact that these things are so small, we can actually put them in aspirin pills now. Believe it or not, an aspirin pill with the power of a PC with a TV camera inside. I actually have a photograph of this. You swallow it. It photographs all your insides and diagnoses any illnesses you may have. This gives new meaning for the expression Intel inside. Also, these things are now being placed in toys, making them intelligent, thus creating a contradiction in terms for the English language, a problem for the English language called smart Barbie dolls. Another contradiction in terms is Microsoft works. That is also a contradiction in terms. Moving on, because I want to wind up, even starships, we physicists believe, might be possible. Here is a solar sail, one of the devices which may take us to a nearby star, a gigantic sail that unfurls. And this is from the movie 2001. How many people here have seen the movie 2001? Raise your hand. How many people have understood that movie? Raise your hand. Well, let me tell you what 2001 is all about. It turns out that there are so many planets in the galaxy that it's silly for Captain Kirk to visit each one. How does a virus colonize your body? A virus colonizes your body by landing on a cell, hijacking the cell, making copies of itself, thousands of copies. They land on other cells, make thousands more. So it exponentially explodes the number of viruses. And in 2 weeks, you're sneezing and coughing. That probe is a virus. It lands on a moon, multiplies on the moon, and then these land on other moons to create more viruses and exponentially explodes. Believe it or not, this is the most efficient way to colonize the galaxy, which means that on our moon, perhaps there is a leftover probe from a passing Type 3 civilization that perhaps is just waiting for us to make contact. Now, my friends also search for intelligent life in outer space. They actively look for intelligent life in outer space, and they tell me the following. Well, first of all, how come they don't visit us? Well, realize that the Earth radiates radio. We radiate television. There is a sphere surrounding the Earth. It is 50 light years in radius, expanding at the speed of television, containing the finest of our cultural TV archives, the noblest achievements of the human creative spirit, like I Love Lucy, and now joined by the immortal classics Beavis and Butthead Part 2 and Dumb and Dumber Part 2. And any star within 50 light years of the Earth will pick up our cultural emissions, and they'll be convinced there is no intelligent life on the Earth. So let me now wind up. A few years ago, I had the rare pleasure of speaking at the Einstein Centennial. Einstein, of course, talked about the potential of time travel. He investigated antimatter, stuff that we see in the science fiction movies. But when Einstein was an old man, he was tired of giving the same talk over and over again. So one day his chauffeur came up to him and he said, "Professor, I've heard your talk so many times, I've memorized it. I'm a part-time actor. So why don't we switch places? I will put on a mustache and a wig. I will be the great Einstein, and you can be my chauffeur and take a rest." Well, Einstein loved that idea, taking a rest, so they switched places. And so the chauffeur gave many, many brilliant talks that he memorized. But one day, in the back, a mathematician asked a very difficult question. And Einstein thought, "Oh, the game is up." But then the chauffeur said, "That question is so elementary that even my chauffeur here will answer it for you." Thank you very much. You've been a great audience. And we'll take questions.
Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist, talking about the physics of the impossible. You're with me, Paul Barclay, on Fora Radio, here on ABC Radio National, or on the web at abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. Let's take you back now to the RSA in London for some questions from the audience.
The first one is kind of a challenge to the kind of core thesis of this book, in a way, which is that science, real science, as it were, is driven forward by science fiction, by our huge aspirations for these great leaps forward. Isn't there another argument, which is quite the reverse, which is to say that scientists somehow, sometimes, it's distracted, it's discredited even, by claims that are made for it, that if you take, for example, what's happened with the human genome. That a few years ago, all sorts of predictions are being made. We'd be able to cure every illness. We'd be able to understand everything. And it turns out it's a lot more complicated than that. And the danger is that, therefore, people start to become disillusioned with the science. So how do you kind of respond to the view that, in some ways, these great ambitions can actually distract us from the more methodical work of small incremental discoveries?
Well, one of the themes of this book is to give you a time frame so you know whether it's years, decades, century, or millennia before we have time machines or warp drive. The journalists who write about these things never put a time frame. They say flying cars, robot maids, robot butlers, we're all going to have them tomorrow. And then people are disillusioned that we're not having robot maids, robot butlers. We don't have flying cars. We don't have flying trains. We don't have hoverboards. So it's the journalists, I think, who take our understanding of physics and run with it and don't give you a time frame. However, in this book, I give you a time frame. Class one impossibilities are years, decades to a century away. Class two are many centuries to millennia. And class three, perhaps, are simply downright impossible. So when we filmed this book, we went into the laboratories. We saw the prototypes. We filmed the prototypes. And you can see how primitive or how advanced some of these technologies are. So I think it's more the journalists who run with these predictions without giving you a perspective as to when these things will come to fruition. Like the Human Genome Project, if you listen to the doctors very carefully, they said flatly, it may take years before we have useful pharmaceuticals that are introduced to the marketplace. But the journalists just saw the Human Genome Project and saw, oh my God, we're going to be able to create Frankensteins, cure diseases, and do all sorts of, create life out of nothing. And they ran with it without telling the true story. And the scientists are always very careful. In fact, we are so careful that we're boring. Boring, and that's why the journalists don't quote us when we say these are years away, because the journalists don't want to hear that stuff. They want to hear the sensational stuff. They want to sell newspapers. Right. So I blame them.
Hello, my name's Herbin Marsh-Williams. Physics of the impossible is very good, thank you. Very much enjoyed it. Whatever may be possible isn't necessarily desirable, and you talked about the fact that you were invited to work on the hydrogen bomb and actually declined. If you were to write a book called Physics of the Undesirable, then what would be in it?
Let me be very clear about this. Where did the internet come from? Was the internet invented by kindly scientists who wanted teenagers to be able to Facebook each other? Is that why the internet was created? No, it was created by the Pentagon. It used to be called ARPANET. ARPANET is what now became the internet. But what happened was, in 1989, with the Soviet bloc breaking up, the National Science Foundation had rights to this gigantic ARPANET, didn't know what to do with it. So you know what they did? They gave it away. They just gave the whole thing away free of charge to the world, and it changed the entire world. Before 1989, 1984 might have been possible. It was a weapon of war. It could have been something to spy on you, like 1984. But now, after 1989, when it was declassified and basically given away, 1984 is impossible. You cannot bottle up the internet anymore. So sometimes we have to realize that even undesirable projects sometimes have enormous beneficial gains. For example, the GPS system. GPS system allows hikers to locate themselves. Mothers can locate their children using GPS now. But why did the Pentagon create the GPS? To fire missiles at the Kremlin, to be able to drop a hydrogen bomb on Brezhnev's desk. That's why they built the GPS system. But again, after 1989, there was no military use for it, really. So most of the technology, the codes for the GPS, are simply given away, okay? So it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict when sometimes an undesirable technology actually becomes the foundation of modern society.
Hi, Paul Kimball. You've written about extraterrestrial civilizations and the possibility that there's a galactic conversation going on that we're not part of, that's far beyond us. Two questions. What do you think might be the best way of tapping into that conversation if it's taking place? Referencing particularly SETI's efforts. And secondly, how soon, if there is such a conversation going on, do you think we might have the physics or the knowledge to tap into such a conversation?
Let me try to answer that. First, why don't the aliens visit us? How would we contact aliens who are out there? Well, if you're walking down a country road and you see an anthill, do you go down to the ants and say, I give you trinkets, I bring you beads,
I give you nuclear energy. I give you biotechnology. Take me to your ant leader. Or maybe you step on a few of them. Well, a galactic civilization that could soar through the galactic space lanes would consider us not too different from an anthill. Now, let's say there's a 10-lane superhighway being built right next to the anthill. Would the ants know how to communicate with the workers? Would they know the frequencies that the workers use when they build a 10-lane superhighway? Would the ants even know what a 10-lane superhighway was, or the purpose of a 10-lane superhighway, right? Then you begin to realize that a galactic civilization is about 1 million years more advanced than us. And on that scale, their frequencies, their culture, their goals are going to be very, very different from our little anthill. So how will we make contact with these people? Well, first of all, this year and next year, everyone in this room is going to have an existential shock because the Kepler satellite went into orbit 2 months ago. It was operational last week. The Kepler satellite is designed to find 600 Earth-like twins in outer space. You're going to have an epiphany at night, looking at the night sky, realizing that here, they're Earth-like twins in outer space, perhaps with oceans, perhaps with oxygen, and we're not going to be the only game in town. And it's going to happen this year. It's going to happen very, very soon. The Coros satellite, even 2 months ago, a ground-based telescope identified an Earth-like planet twice the size of the Earth, already in outer space. Once we identify these planets, then we can zero in and listen to their frequencies. Unfortunately, the hydrogen frequencies are probably the worst place to look, but that's all we know. We are so primitive, we only know of one frequency to listen in on, and so we'll try to listen in on the hydrogen frequencies because hydrogen gas is everywhere and try to identify these civilizations. So we could be in the middle of a gigantic intergalactic conversation, but we're too stupid to know it. We don't know their frequencies. We don't know how they communicate. For example, your email. When you send an email, it's chopped up into many pieces and reassembled at the other end. Why? Because your email, that's why you have this header at the beginning of your email. It's chopped up because it was a military weapon. The message is chopped up because in the future, Los Angeles may be destroyed, New York may be destroyed, and your email will still get through because it's been chopped up into pieces. Even though parts of the world are destroyed, your email will still get through. Let's say an alien civilization does the same thing. They take a message, chop it up, send it through many, many avenues to have it reassembled at the other end. That's the most efficient way, error-free way to send a message. If we were to listen in on alien signals, we'd hear nothing. We'd hear gibberish. So we could be teeming with intergalactic civilizations, and we're simply too stupid to know it. Okay.
Part of the problem for human beings is that we have a prehistoric brain trying to deal with the modern world. So the organ in our head has lived in very, very similar circumstances of 200,000 years, and then suddenly it's presented with very difficult circumstances. Do you think it's possible to accelerate evolution?
Okay, I agree with you that modern humans that look just like us emerged from Africa about 100,000, 200,000 years ago. You take a caveman, give him a shave, aftershave lotion, three-piece suit, put him on Wall Street, and they look like all the other barbarians on Wall Street. Except now, of course, you give them nuclear weapons, okay? That's the difference. We have the caveman mind with all the caveman instincts, caveman appetites, with nuclear weapons.
But do you think because as we start to understand neuroscience, we're actually capable of advancing our own evolution? That's my question.
Yeah, this is a subject of enormous debate, whether or not we should create designer children, okay? Right now, for example, we have found the gene for smart mice that have better memory. In fact, for BBC television, we filmed it, and we showed it on a special that I presented, where mice have been genetically bred to have better memory. And you see the difference between ordinary mice and the super mice. Also, we found the Mighty Mouse gene, a gene that makes mice muscle-bound. We found it in a young boy, the Mighty Mouse gene, so we can't call it the Mighty Mouse gene anymore. We call it the Schwarzenegger gene. Well, the Schwarzenegger gene makes a young boy muscle-bound. We found that gene, too. And the guy who did it at the University of Pennsylvania got a lot of phone calls. But he was very depressed when 50% of the phone calls that came in were not from doctors treating patients with muscular dystrophy. 50% of the phone calls came from muscle builders who wanted to bulk up on the Mighty Mouse gene. So how do you stop that? I mean, how do you stop people from, on their own, getting the Mighty Mouse gene, getting the Smart Mouse gene, and finding human counterparts of it, and then selling it in Hong Kong and in black markets? How do you stop that? That's going to be a big problem. There's a demand for that stuff. If you find out that your son or daughter is competing against another child who is suspected to be enhanced, you're going to say, well, that's unfair. I'm going to enhance my child, too. So I think genetic enhancements today is very minimal. It's only basically the Mighty Mouse gene that the Olympics is worried about. But pretty soon, we're going to have a whole collection of these genes isolated, and people will want it. Parents will demand it. So how do you stop that?
Dr. Michio Kaku there discussing his most recent book, The Physics of the Impossible, which is published by Penguin. Thanks to the RSA in London for that presentation. And if you'd like to listen or watch Dr. Kaku's address in full, it's available on the RSA website. There's a direct link to it at abc.net.au/rn/fora-radio. You're listening to Fora Radio on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web. I'm Paul Barclay. And now let me take you to the Stanton Library in North Sydney in a talk by ABC journalist and author Sally Naber. Her book is called The Mother of Muhammad. It's a story of Robin Hutchinson, who began her life in a country town in New South Wales. She later changed her name to Rabia and ended up spending 4 years working as a doctor in a Mujahideen hospital and orphanage on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border in the early 1990s. She later returned to Afghanistan under the Taliban and married a leading al-Qaeda ideologue and member of Osama bin Laden's inner circle. Today, Rabia Hutchinson is officially designated a threat to national security and prevented from travelling abroad because she might destabilise foreign governments, in the words of an ASIO assessment. Here now is Sally Naber, who picks up the story when Rabia first went to Pakistan and met Osama bin Laden.
And so she took her 6 children, the youngest of whom was still breastfeeding, to the northwest province of Pakistan, which, of course, as we now know, is currently in the throes of, you know, an incredibly bloody struggle involving the reborn Taliban. So back in those days, the northwest province was the main base for the Afghan Mujahideen parties, who had fought the Soviets in Afghanistan and had defeated the Soviets in 1989, and at this point were still fighting to oust the pro-Soviet government that had been left behind in Kabul. And so Rabia went off with her 6 kids, joined the party of one of the Afghan warlords, a man named Sayaf, went to work for 4 years in his Mujahideen camp in the orphanage and school there, working essentially with the Afghan refugees, of whom there were many millions around Peshawar at that time. And she talks about this time living in this mud brick house in this little desert town called Pabi, full of cockroaches and scorpions and no electricity and no running water and cholera and typhoid and, you know, every other disease known to man just about. She talks about this time as, you know, the happiest time of her life. She loved it. She was just so at home there. And she, in some senses, she talks about how it reminded her of her childhood days growing up in Mudgee and another town near Mudgee where she lived called Wallah, where she describes how her family lived in a house with a dirt floor and her mother used to cook on the open fire, I should say. That was so poor. And so, you know, living in Pakistan in these primitive conditions reminded her of her childhood, and she loved it. And it was there that she first made contact with Osama bin Laden. And I'll read you a little extract from the book about that episode. Osama bin Laden was the patron and financier of this Afghan warlord, Sayaf, and was often seen around Sayaf's camp, where he was known as this, you know, generous benefactor who had sacrificed his wealth and his own comfort to support the holy struggle. It didn't take long after Rabia's arrival in Pabi for bin Laden to learn of the presence of the foreign mujahida with 6 children, known as Muhammad meaning the mother of Muhammad, Muhammad Australi. As Rabia tells it, bin Laden was walking down the street past her house with a companion, an Algerian known as Abu Abdul, when he spotted her playing in the street. Their conversation was related to her afterwards by Abu Abdul's wife, who was Rabia's best friend in Pabi. "I bet you can't guess where those children are from," Abu Abdul remarked. "They look sort of Arab," bin Laden replied, noticing the children's olive complexions inherited from their Indonesian fathers. "No, they're Australian." "Subhanallah, praise Allah," bin Laden is said to have exclaimed. "Australian, that must be a first." It's a woman on her own, Abu Abdul continued. She came with her children. She works in the hospital. She doesn't have anything. They don't even have air conditioning. Well, they do now, Bin Laden replied. A few days later, an emissary delivered a brand new air conditioner to her home, courtesy of Osama Bin Laden, Rabia was told. And it goes on, there was another incident after that where one day Rabia's children were playing in the street, and once again Bin Laden was strolling down the street with the same friend and bumped into the children, who he remembered as the children from Australia. And they were going down to the bakery, which was, you know, a little lean-to hush down the road where an Afghan baker had a tandoor buried in the dirt where he would cook naan for the villagers. And so the children were heading to the bakery, and Bin Laden said, "I'll come with you." And so they got down to the bakery, and it was full of refugee families who were crowding for their daily supply of naan, which, of course, was one of the staples of the Afghan diet. And Bin Laden noticed that the baker had all these wooden sticks on a shelf with notches in them, and the system worked such that the families who couldn't afford to buy bread on a particular day, he had a credit system, so he would carve a little notch in the stick and that represented the money they owed him. And later, when they had enough money, they'd come back and pay for their bread. And so Bin Laden's response to this, according to Rabia's daughter, who recounted this story to me, was to pay for everybody's bread for a month or several months. And I'll just go on from the book here. Bin Laden's gesture caused quite a scene at the crowded bakery by Rahma, Rabia's daughter's account. Women began chanting Allah Akbar and uttering prayers of thanks while young boys mobbed him, trying to kiss his hands. Rahma says Bin Laden was so embarrassed that he raised his hands above his shoulders so they couldn't be grabbed and kissed while he retreated from the crowd. I found that story interesting, and there were lots of stories like that about Bin Laden, which really contributed to the iconic status that he enjoyed among the people who had joined the jihad. And I think, you know, it's important to remember that when we think about, you know, why Bin Laden's appeal was and has been so enduring. It's because that's the way he's seen, I think, by many Muslims, as this incredibly generous and kindly benefactor who has, you know, supported and fought on behalf of oppressed Muslims. And they still romanticise and idealise him in that way. So later on, Rabia spent 4 years in Pakistan, and then later on in 2000, she went back to Pakistan and then went into Afghanistan, where the Taliban was by now in power. At this point, as a result of her previous contact with Bin Laden, she actually describes how she wrote a letter to him, which was passed on by a friend of hers, saying, offering her services as a health worker and saying, "Where can I be most useful, in Kandahar or Kabul?" And she got a message back saying, "You should go to Kabul." So she did, and set up a medical clinic where she provided medical services to people in need, mostly the people of the Taliban and al-Qaeda. So she became very much a part of their inner circle, to the point that she was actually invited by Bin Laden's 2IC, Ayman al-Zawahiri, to establish a new women's hospital for al-Qaeda in Kandahar. And it was at this time also that she married this very senior al-Qaeda figure, Abu Walid, who was on Bin Laden's Shura Council. So, as I say, was very much an insider in the jihadist elite. So Rabia was in Afghanistan when when the September 11 attacks occurred. You know, it's really one of the few — I've never heard an inside account from anyone who was in Afghanistan with the bad guys, you know, when September 11 occurred. And incidentally, part of the lead up to this was that there had been a split within the al-Qaeda leadership over this looming attack on America. Bin Laden had largely plotted this September 11 attack through Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who we now know is in Guantanamo Bay because he has admitted to being, you know, the main architect of the September 11 attacks. And Bin Laden had told the Shura Council about 2 or 3 weeks before the event that there was to be this attack on America. And there'd been very intense debate within the Shura Council about this, because a lot of the al-Qaeda leadership believed it was sheer folly and suicidal to attack America, because America's counterattack would just wipe them out. They knew that would happen. And so there was a lot of opposition to this idea, and Rabia's husband, Abu Walid was one of the al-Qaeda leaders who most strenuously opposed it. And he subsequently became a very bitter critic of bin Laden's as a result of that, because he felt that bin Laden had betrayed the Afghanis, had destroyed the jihad movement, and had eventually destroyed Afghanistan, or, well, had certainly, you know, destroyed Afghanistan's hope of having an Islamic state, which is what they all aspired to, and had led to, the ferocious attacks on Afghanistan. But this is what happened on the day of September 11. Rabia was watering the garden in the courtyard of Abu Walid's home in Kandahar. He had gone off to the Ministry of Information for a meeting. I was in the yard watering the garden and I heard all the gunshots, Rabia remembers. The whole place erupted. There was gunfire and people screaming and yelling out Allah Akbar and blowing their car horns in the street and great excitement. Next, Abu Walid came running through the gates. They've attacked the Twin Towers, he shouted. What Twin Towers, she asked, amid the din and confusion. In New York, they've flown planes into the World Trade Center. Who? Who else? Abu Walid ran back out the door of the Al Jazeera house. He worked for the Arabic TV station Al Jazeera, saying he was going to watch the satellite television coverage of the event. He returned 2 hours later. He came back and he was really white, really pale, and he looked really, really sad, says Rabia. What's happened, she asked him. The Shabab, young men, have flown two planes into the World Trade Center in New York. He paused and added, this is a disaster. Then Abu Walid put his face in his hands and wept, repeating over and over, Yallah, oh God, what have they done? And so after that, of course, 3 weeks later, the Americans bombed Afghanistan, and Rabia and her children, who were still with her, four of them anyway, went on the run with the other Taliban and al-Qaeda fugitives. And she describes this extraordinary three-month period where they were literally running from safe house to safe house, sometimes staying in underground shelters or abandoned buildings as the American cluster bombs fell around them. And, people were being killed and all sorts of horrific carnage was taking place, as is now well documented. Finally, after 3 months on the run, she realised that she was going to have to leave Afghanistan, and she didn't want to. Even after all that had occurred, she wanted to stay in Afghanistan. But finally they realised they had no choice, so they crossed the border illegally into Iran. And she describes, running across the desert to the barbed wire fence and crawling under the barbed wire. And then ended up in Tehran, where, as I said, they were detained under house arrest by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And the reason that occurred was that her husband, Abu Walid, was already there and was known to be a senior al-Qaeda figure. And many senior al-Qaeda figures had escaped to Iran. And initially they were given refuge, effectively, or at least tacitly allowed by the authorities. But as the Americans started to put pressure on the Iranians, they were gathered up and placed under house arrest. So they were still allowed to stay there, but they were their movements were very closely watched and controlled. So this was the situation that Rabia found herself in. And she stayed like that with her children for about another year, year and a half. And finally, her marriage to Abu Walid ended. And she decided, she felt that she was no longer eligible for protection, that she was now in a very perilous situation, because she always felt that it wasn't her that the Iranians were interested, but him, and that once she was no longer married to him, anything could happen. She could be thrown out on the street or tossed back across the border. So she gave herself up at the Australian embassy, which was very interested to hear from her, because, of course, they knew well of her movements and activities by now. And she was repatriated to Australia in 2003.
Sally Naber, ABC journalist and author, speaking at the Stanton Library in North Sydney. Her book, The Mother of Muhammad, is published by Melbourne University Press. And that's it for Fora Radio this week. You can see Sally Naber's address this Sunday at 6 p.m. on ABC2. And the full-length version will be posted on ABC Fora online later this week. There'll be a direct link to it on the Fora Radio website when it becomes available. And I'm back tomorrow night with Australia Talks. Have you been following the Stern Hu case? I'm sure many of you have. He's the Rio Tinto executive being held in detention without charge over alleged espionage. What does the incident mean for political relations with China and for business? And how should the Australian government react? Call in with your views on Australia Talks tomorrow. And I'll speak to you then.
Hi, Peter Mayers here. Who really calls the policy shots in Canberra? Is it political staffers, as depicted in the TV series The Hollow Men? Is it career civil servants, the Sir Humphrey Applebys of Yes Minister fame? Or perhaps it is, actually, our elected leaders? Laying bare the operations of government, a public conversation from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. In the National Interest, download or stream this program from the Radio National website.